So far in our introduction to the book of Revelation and apocalyptic literature, we have learned that the book of Revelation contains an apocalypse, an unveiling, which God vouchsafed to his son Yeshua, which he entrusted in turn to his angel, who passed it to John, who in turn wrote down all that he saw and heard, right? And then John delivers it to the seven assemblies of his apostolate, and ultimately it comes to us. And here we are, you know, this 1900 years later. So this is the Revelation. And in verse 9 of the first chapter, John explains, he says, "I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus." How did John end up on an island called Patmos? Small Greek island in the Aegean Sea. If I was clever, I would have thought to bring my computer and put up a map that would show us, you know, the Ephesus and the curve of Asia Minor as it sticks out in the Aegean, and I could show you where Patmos is, but I didn't think of that. Anyway, how did John end up on this little rocky island? It's a long story, and I'm going to give you a quick overview of this long story, but if you really want to study it out in detail, I recommend Chronicles of the Apostles. That's where you can get this information. But I'll tell you the story of how John arrived on Patmos, but first I'm going to back it up 36 years. 36 years earlier, when John, the son of Zebedee, and his brother James, John and James, were still following the Master along with 10 other disciples, and they're on their way up to Jerusalem for the Passover. Actually, they didn't know this, but it was the last Passover that they were going to spend with the Master. And there's someplace, as they're on their way, you know, they're somewhere around Jericho, just about to go up that ascent to Jerusalem, when their mom, Shulamit, the mother of James and John, approaches Yeshua and says, "I have a request." And he says, "What do you want?" And she says, "Just that my two sons would be able to sit on your right and your left in your kingdom." Now in the story, Yeshua turns to the two sons. I don't know, I think they were feeling a little awkward about this at this time. So he turns to the two boys, and he says to them, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" And they reply in the affirmative, "We are able." They should have asked, "What's in the cup?" He says to them, "My cup you shall drink, but to sit at my right and my left, this is not mine to give, but it's for those the Father has appointed, or has been prepared by my Father." That's an interesting story. And I think this story needs to be measured against the story of the Transfiguration, when the Master says to his disciples, James, John, and to all the 12, he says, "Some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." And then he takes aside James and John and Peter, and they go up onto the mountain, onto the high mountain. So the cup of the Master that he predicts that James and John are certainly going to drink is the cup of suffering. It is the cup of martyrdom. So in this light, I find it significant that, since they will drink the cup of martyrdom, I find it significant that the very first of the 12 disciples to taste that cup, to die, is James, the older brother. James, the son of Zebedee, put to death by Herod Agrippa, right there in the book of Acts, beheaded by Herod Agrippa. All right, so, boom, he drinks the Master's cup. But John, on the other hand, is the last survivor of the 12. I mean, we're talking about John being on the island of Patmos in the year 95, some 36 years later. And
You know, James is the first, John is the last. So I have this idea. Imagine it like a meal, a banquet, a table with the disciples reclining around the table. And the master takes his cup and he passes it to the disciple. He drinks of it himself. He passes it to the disciple on his right. I'm not saying this really happened. I'm just saying imagine this, okay? Passes it to the disciple on his right. It's James. James drinks from the cup of martyrdom. Then James passes it to the disciple on his right. And this cup makes its way all around the table through the 12 disciples until it comes back to the disciple seated on his left, the last to taste the cup of martyrdom, John. Let these two sons of mine sit at your right and your left in the kingdom. But was John ever martyred? On the contrary, church tradition says that John lived to an advanced age and died of natural causes, a natural death. So how can we speak of him drinking of the master's cup, the same cup that his brother James drank from? Well, all right, here's the story. Now we're ready. That's like the prelude. Now we're ready to tell the story. And this, if I was to title this story, we could call it The Age of Persecution. That's the title I gave the lecture. But I think a better title would be Two Things Are Certain, Death and Taxes. Because that's what this is about. It begins with a tax problem. When the Roman Emperor Vespasian conquered Jerusalem and stomped out the Jewish revolt, he enacted two special measures. First of all, he imposed a severe penalty on Jewish households to punish them for revolting against Rome. And this is called the Fiscus Judaicus, which means the Jewish tax. Fiscus Judaicus. It was a 2 drachma annual poll tax levied on every Jew. A heavy punishing tax, especially for Jewish families, which tend to be very large. You know, you could have like 10, 12 children. It's very expensive every year. And what's worse, the money went to fund the Temple of Jupiter in Rome. It was a symbolic gesture which was supposed to indicate that the God of Israel had been defeated by the God of Rome. And it was also a lucrative measure. Okay, so that was the first thing he did. The second thing he imposed was the hunting of the house of David. For some reason, which I'll explain to you in a little bit, Vespasian got it into his head that he needed to prevent the coming of the Messiah by hunting down and killing all the descendants of the house of David. And we know this, we learn this from Eusebius' Ecclesiastical History, where he writes, "After the conquest of Jerusalem, Vespasian gave orders that everyone who belonged to the lineage of David should be sought out, in order that none of the royal race might be left among the Jews. Because of this, a most terrible persecution again hung over the Jews." All right, so that's Vespasian. That's in the year 70, the year of the destruction of the temple. 20 years later, when Vespasian's wicked son Domitian became the emperor, Domitian nearly bankrupted the empire, and he needed to raise money. And one place he looked for extra revenue, well, what does the government always do when they need extra revenue? They look for ways to increase taxes. And he started to look at the Jewish tax, the Fiscus Judaicus, and he discovered that there were some Jews in the empire who had been concealing their Jewish identity in order to avoid paying this tax, which makes a lot of sense. Now, the thing about you need to know about Domitian, the Emperor Domitian, is that he is a very, very religious man. Domitian feared the gods. His father, Vespasian, not so much. Vespasian was a soldier. He rose through the ranks, became a general. He was a man's man. He made his own way in the world with or without the gods. Same with his son Titus. But Domitian was religious. He was a believer. in the gods. And he especially honored Jupiter and Minerva. And he restored the temple of Jupiter, and he covered it with a golden roof. And not only did he reverence the gods, he reverenced himself as a god. Now, the Roman emperors were always gods. Everybody knows Roman emperors are gods. But most of the emperors didn't take that too seriously themselves. You know, that was sort of a joke. Domitian took it very seriously. He had images of himself put up all over Rome and all over the empire, which he required people to worship. And he demanded that everyone should address him as our master and our god, Domitian. And in addition to all of this, he had a strange sadistic streak, which was reminiscent of Nero. It kind of freaked people out. Even the Roman historians were troubled by some of the things he would do. And the believers started to wonder if this might be a second Nero. Nero had been the main persecutor and he was the emperor that had put Peter to death. Circus Neronius and all that. Anyway, so here's the story. Domitian needs to raise taxes. He says, we need to find these tax evaders. And so he encourages his citizens to report anyone suspected of, you know, being secretly Jewish. Because there's people out there who are they look like normal people, but they're secretly Jewish. And so he has people informing on whoever you think might be Jewish. And what surprised him was how many informers came forward. Something he had not anticipated. Hundreds, even thousands of accusations came forward. Not about actual Jews, it turned out, but about Gentiles, the Roman historians say, who had drifted into Jewish ways and Jewish superstitions. These were the believers. These were the God-fearing Gentile believers who had abandoned the old gods and begun to worship the God of the Jews. They were keeping the Sabbath day, they were worshiping in the Jewish manner, and from the Roman perspective, they were illegal Jews, hiding their Jewishness in order to avoid paying taxes. Now, this really troubled Domitian. It wasn't just the lost revenue and taxes that he could have been collecting. What really troubled him was the idea of good Roman citizens and other Gentiles of the emperor, non-Jews of the empire, forsaking the gods of Rome and adopting what the Romans called atheism. I mean, this is really troubling because what's going to happen? These people are going to tick the gods off. Then there's going to be all sorts of calamities thanks to these atheists. They're called, we call them monotheists. That wasn't a concept in the ancient world, outside of Judaism. The Romans called monotheists atheists. It was okay to be an atheist if you're Jewish. The Jews had an exemption. They had an exemption from the days of Augustus, actually. And maybe even before Augustus. I think it's from the days of Augustus. They had an exemption where the Romans said, you know what, you've been Jews a long time. You've only been worshiping your one God a long time. That's okay with us. You don't have to worship our gods. But that only applies to Jewish people, all right? It didn't apply to non-Jews. So Domitian finds out there's all these people who are Roman citizens who are practicing atheism. They've fallen into Jewish ways. They've fallen into Jewish monotheism. So he decides, you know, who's to blame for this? The Jewish community is to blame for this. So he decides to punish the Jewish community with a general persecution. And I forgot to tell you this. He was surprised to find out that even members of his own family had fallen into this superstition. His cousin and her husband. And this is extremely troubling to him. I think her name was Domitilla. This was extremely troubling to him, because he had adopted their sons as his heirs. So this meant that the next emperor of Rome, after Domitian died, would have been a believer. like 200 years before Constantine, you would have had a believer say, what? Domitian found out about this. Found out about this. She blames the Jewish community for secretly influencing, seducing, proselytizing, passing out tracts, whatever they're doing, you know, for spreading their atheistic ideas. And so he says, you know, we have to deal with this. And he's about to sign an edict against the whole Jewish population of the Roman Empire. When the Jewish the Jewish people hear about this, Jewish leaders, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, perhaps, Rabbi Gamliel ben Shimon, the Yavne crowd, make an emergency trip to Rome to meet with Domitian. And they say, look, you can't blame the whole Jewish community. It's not the fault of the whole Jewish community. It's these people. there's one certain sect called the Nazarenes, the Christians. That is the Jewish believers in Yeshua. Now, how do we know this? I'm putting this together from a couple different sources. And the Talmud narrates the emergency trip to Rome. It narrates Rabbi Akiva and Gamliel meeting with Domitilla and her husband. It tells this story. An apocryphal church document called the Acts of John narrate this story about the Jewish community and the persecution that's going to be launched against the Jewish community. You have to take the Roman historians like Suetonius tell the story about how many Gentiles have fallen into Jewish ways and the levying of the Jewish tax. You kind of have to put it. You have to have your fingers in all these different sources to get the whole story. Anyway. Thanks to the quick work of Gamliel and Gamliel ben Shimon and Rabbi Akiva, Domitian cancels his plans to persecute the Jewish community. Instead, he gives new orders, calling on informers to identify these Christians and separate them out from the Jews. And to make a distinction, because here's the thing, Judaism is legal. It's a legal sect. As long as you pay your taxes, it's okay to be Jewish. That's fine. But it's not legal for Gentiles. And so Gentiles convicted of practicing it were to be arrested, their possessions seized by the state, and many were put to death. I mean, noblemen and aristocrats were exiled to remote islands, like his cousin Domitilla was exiled to an island. In addition to this, he relaunched his father's campaign against the house of David. Why? I have a theory on this. I don't know this for sure, but it was puzzling to me. Why does Domitian care about Jewish prophecies about a Messiah coming from the house of David? Why is this bothering him? And it occurred to me that when his father, Vespasian, was making war against Judea, a certain Jewish trader by the name of Josephus surrendered to him and gave him a prophecy and said, "You will be the next emperor of Rome." He said, "I don't believe you, but I'm going to keep you in chains to see if your prophecy comes true." And the Talmud says that during the siege of Jerusalem, Yochanan ben Zakkai escaped in a coffin, was brought to Vespasian, and he said to him, "You will be the next emperor of Rome." And then it happened that the word came that Nero was dead. Vespasian returned to Rome, became the next emperor. But according to what Josephus told him, Josephus said that he was fulfilling the prophecies, the Jewish prophecies, of a world ruler that was to arise at that time. So in other words, Vespasian and the Flavian house considered themselves to be the heirs of the messianic promises of the Jews. They considered themselves to be King Messiah. And so Domitian this is my own theory, but it's supported from the text. So Domitian wants the competition removed, the house of David. Anyway, it's in the midst of this. It's in the midst of all of this great debacle that Domitian hears about. Well, first he hears that, you know, there's the story of, he hears about the grandsons of Jude, the brother of the master. He has them arrested, brought to him, because they're from the house of David. It's a famous story. Anyway, he also hears about the existence of one of the original disciples of the Nazarene living in Ephesus, alive in Ephesus. And so he has John arrested. John's an old man at this point. He's in his 80s or his 90s. He's still serving as an apostle. And he's brought to Rome. Church tradition fills in the details of what happens. It's according to the tradition, according to legends. These are all legends at this point. We don't really know how it went down. But according to the legends, he's brought to Rome and Domitian tries to give him poison to drink, gives him a cup of poison to drink. Remember, yes, you will drink of my cup. He gives him a cup of poison to drink. But remember when Yeshua said, if they drink any deadly poison, it will not hurt them. And John survives the poison, which is startling to Domitian. You know, the Romans were adept with poisons. They're like always poisoning each other. It's like, if they weren't going to the theater, they were poisoning each other for reading Lives of the Great Poisoners. That was their favorite pastime. But the poison failed. So Domitian is frustrated with this, and he decides to make a public display of John's execution, and he has a pot of oil heated up, you know, puts a fire under a big cauldron of oil. Tertullian, the church father Tertullian, mentions this episode. It says, the city of Rome is where Peter suffered like his master, where Paul won his crown in a death like John the Baptist, where the apostle John was plunged, unhurt, into boiling oil. Unhurt. Death by boiling. Have you ever heard of that? It's actually a form of execution. You know, this is that was practiced in the ancient world, was practiced in the Roman world, this grisly death. You know, what you do is they could use water, oil, tar, fat, anything, and then they would lower the victim into it, and you'd have a big crowd around to watch, and then they'd pull the victim back up, you know, and what was left of them, flesh hanging off of the bones type of thing. This is, I know, it's a horrible, horrible form of execution, commensurate with Roman cruelty. It was finally outlawed in the 16th century. So, it was outlawed, I mean, in other words, about 400 years ago, not very long ago. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm sure it's still used as a form of torture in some evil regimes. But according to the legend, a miracle happened. And when they pulled John up out of the boiling oil, he was all slickery with the oil, but unharmed. And at this point, you know, Domitian, he's already a superstitious, paranoid kind of person. He was very afraid of John. And he said, I can't poison him, I can't kill him, so what's he left to do? He banishes him to the island of Patmos, which happened to a lot of people. Roman legal practice was more lenient with members of the aristocracy than with the lower classes. In the case of the lower class, a man might receive a death penalty. An aristocrat usually would just get banishment. And there were two types of banishment. You could be banished as in never come back to the city of Rome or whatever. You can't ever come back to Italy. Or you could be relegated. To be relegated meant to be sent to a little island, and you could never leave the island. John is relegated. And so church history says that John remained on Patmos then until the death of Domitian. The next emperor reversed all of it. The Nerva released all of Domitian's political prisoners. But at that point, John returned to Ephesus. Anyway, that's the story of John's imprisonment on Patmos and how he got there. But more than that, this is the story of Domitian's persecution against the believers that triggers the rupture between Judaism and the church. That crew that came to Rome, Akiva, Gamaliel, the Yavne crowd, they went back to Yavne and composed a new blessing for the liturgy that we call Against Heretics, the Birkat Hamanim. And there's a passage in the book of Revelation. I should read it to you. I'm just going to read this to you. Because I want to get the wording just so. It's often misused. It's a favorite passage of anti-Semites. It's a puzzling passage outside of the historical context. It's in Revelation 2, verse 9, to this. The assembly at Smyrna, it says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested and you will have tribulation for 10 days. That's the passage, the synagogue of Satan. See, ordinarily people in the past have interpreted this to mean that synagogues are satanic. And the worship that takes place in a synagogue is satanic, or the Jewish people are satanic. And this has been used to justify hatred against Judaism and the Jewish people. But what's really going on in this passage? Who are the Jews, or the people who say they are Jews, but are not Jews, that worship in a synagogue of Satan? What's going on in this passage? Let's think about this. What was going on in Asia Minor, in Smyrna? Here's what was going on. We had an assembly. Here we have an assembly. And in this assembly, there's two kinds of people worshiping. There are Jewish people and people who are not Jewish. Jewish people and Gentiles. Most of the Gentiles, the majority of the Gentiles in that context, are believers. That's why they're in the synagogue, because they've fallen in love with the God of Israel. They've become monotheists through their faith in Yeshua of Nazareth and the testimony of Yeshua. Then the Roman government says to the leadership of these congregations, you need to give us a list. You need to tell us if there's any people in your assembly who are not Jewish. Because that's illegal, to be an atheist, to be a monotheist. And if they're not Jewish and not paying the Jewish tax, then they need to testify. They need to come before the tribunal. And so it would be up to the synagogue leaders to say, that guy, that guy, that guy, that guy. And then these people would have to appear before the tribunal. When you go before the tribunal, you'll be asked a very simple question. Are you a disciple? Are you a believer in the crucified one? In the one they call Yeshua? The one they call Jesus? You can answer yes. And usually when people answered yes, the governor would say, I'm going to give you a chance to answer that again. I want you to think about your answer more carefully this time. But if they would answer yes again, then they were liable to whatever punishment, very often the death penalty. Maybe if they're not a Roman citizen, crucifixion or something. If the answer no, I am not, then the emperor or the governor would say, great. All we need you to do, then, is to verify that. Could you just worship this image of our emperor, our Lord and our God, Domitian? Burn some incense to him, pour out a libation to him.
And if you would do that, you're off the hook. You're good to go. If you wouldn't do that, they'd know that you had fallen into Jewish ways, that you were a monotheist. And it wasn't going to be good for you. So, Yeshua says, those who say they are Jews but are not Jews. And what's happened here is he's reversed the accusation of those who are pointing out those who are not Jews. And he's reversed this language. Because what you have is these, they're saying, that guy's not a Jew, that guy's not a Jew, that guy's not a Jew. And so our master says, they say they are Jews, but are not Jews. In other words, they're not acting as Jews when they're informing on you, when they're informing the government. One of the greatest sins that you can commit in the Jewish community is to inform on another Jew, to turn another Jew over to the government. In fact, that blessing, Birkat Hamanim, no longer is an invective or a curse against believers. The language has been changed, so it's mostly now just a curse against informers. So by reversing this language, he's saying these are the Jews in the synagogues where you used to worship, and they've pointed the finger at you, they've turned you over to the authorities. That's not acting Jewish. It's similar to, if I was to put it this way, people who say they are Christians but are not Christian. You would understand what I mean. Christians in name only. Christians in name only. Here we're dealing with people who were Jewish in name only, but not acting in a Jewish manner. So why does he call it a synagogue of Satan? Satan is the accuser. Satan is the accuser of the brethren. So to accuse, as in a court of law, you're sending them to the tribunal, that is to become a synagogue of the accuser. This one, this one, this one, this one. Does it make sense? So that's the meaning. It's not any kind of anti-Semitic sentiment coming out of the book of Revelation. But rather, that's the context where it belongs. In any case, this is the broader context for the whole book, this persecution. And this Jewish tax forced this break between the synagogue and the believers that's still with us to this very day, actually. Under Domitian's persecution, the only way for the Jewish community to protect their own legal status under Roman law was to expel the believers. They really didn't have a choice but to expel the believers and to inform about them. So the believers suffered under Domitian more than they had under any emperor before, and that includes Nero. That includes the Neronian persecution, which was pretty brief, actually. Domitian's legislation against the believers had the believers asking one another, who is this guy? Could this be the Antichrist? Could this be the beast? And they called him Nero Redux, the second Nero. Who else but Antichrist is going to demand to be addressed as my Lord and my God, thinks he's the Messiah, and has his images cluttered all over the empire, and demands that you worship them? So anyone accused of being a Christian then needed to renounce the name of Messiah before that tribunal, before Domitian's image. Anyone who wanted to save their life needed to worship the beast and his image. Roman law protected Roman citizens from being put to death by torture. You couldn't take a Roman citizen and dip him in a vat of oil. You couldn't take a Roman citizen and nail him up to a tree. Instead, if you're a Roman citizen, you just cut off his head. And, you know, it's a merciful way to be put to death. So that's why Paul was beheaded, whereas Peter, who didn't have citizenship, was crucified. A Roman citizen had the right to beheading, and so we read in the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verse 4, about those who are beheaded because of their testimony
of Yeshua. What is their testimony of Yeshua? That's testifying before the tribunal. Are you a disciple? Are you a follower of the crucified one they call Yeshua? Yes, I am. If you're a Roman citizen, beheaded because of the testimony of Yeshua and because of the word of God. It says, those who had not worshipped the beast or his image. Other believers, like John, went into banishment and exile, relegated to exile, as it says in Revelation 13, verse 10, if anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone to be killed with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Now, I'm giving you the historical context of the book of Revelation. It gives you a handle to understand the situation, what you're reading about. But you might suppose, by hearing this, you might suppose that this puts me in the category that we could call, theologians refer to as preterism. That I am a, have you anyone heard that word before? Preterism. Okay, a few of you have heard that word. A preterist. A preterist is someone who believes that the entire book of Revelation was fulfilled in the first century. And much of what I'm telling you sounds that way. However, remember our opening premise. Therefore, write the things which you have seen, things which are, and things which will take place after these things. John was to record the visions of things that he had seen. I believe that's things in the past. Things which are, that's things happening in 95 Common Era, when he was on Patmos and this persecution was in full swing. And things which will take place after these things, even until the end of the age. This statement covers the whole range of history that we'll find addressed in the book of Revelation. And some of the content pertains to events before John wrote on Patmos. Some pertains to things that were happening while he wrote. And some pertains to things that were to happen afterward. And in fact, much of it pertains to the end of days and the future that is still coming. And it's still pertinent to us today because we see these patterns replay themselves again and again and again through history as one contender for the title of Antichrist after another rises up and says, choose me, let me be the beast that stomps out the people of God. We learned that this past, present, future focus of Revelation then corresponds to the acclamation, which is the whole point of the apocalypse. The whole point of the apocalypse is that no matter how dark it gets down here and how many people are trying to dip us in hot boiling vats of oil, the one on the throne is still Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Holy, holy, holy. The Lord God, the Almighty, who was, who is, and who is to come. Who was, past tense. Who is, present tense. Who is to come. The future ahead. So the vision that John saw on Patmos extends all the way to the kingdom of heaven and all the way through the kingdom until the new heavens and the new earth, Olam Haba, the world to come. And I believe that part of this reason, part of the reason that John received this revelation, this is again one of my own theories, one of the reasons that John was privileged to see all of this in the second coming of Yeshua, was in order that our master's words should not fall to the ground when he said, there are some of those standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, which is something that John saw, albeit only through an unveiling. We have a little bit of time for questions before the evening is over. So if there's a few questions, I can answer a few of those questions. It doesn't have to be about the book of Revelation, but something somewhat pertinent would be nice. Otherwise, no questions. Great. There is one. Okay.
Is there anything in the Dominion time period that was a
Okay, so the mark, right, I know. I didn't, that would be, it's a whole nother topic, it's a whole nother subject. I have material on that in the Torah Club, Chronicles of the Messiah. The mark of the beast, we can argue about what it is. It's a barcode, it's a, you know, it's a chip that's going to be implanted, you know. I always wondered how, you know, since this prophecy is so explicit about, you know, you get the mark of the beast, you're damned. Right? So, I always wondered, how are they going to sell that? That's going to be a real marketing miracle. You know, and so I thought, you know, how do you do this? Maybe you're going to get, like, what? A free month of cable TV or something with it? Or, you know, it's kind of a puzzle. I'm not sure exactly, you know, how we should interpret that, but the number of the name is pretty clear that this is gematria, this is Jewish gematria being played out in Greek in this case. But yeah, so that's something we could talk about at another time and study at another time. But it does have pertinence to the first century and to these Caesars, Nero and Domitian. Yes. Yes.
I guess it's tricky asking questions because the majority of us are in the process of completely revising our perspective on Rome. So within the understanding, and you can tell me if this is flawed, that the part that is both past and present, as John is writing, as well as the part which is future, there is a Rome.
There is a pardon?
Rome exists in the context of the narrative as he explains it. So
yes. That's not inaccurate at all. Do you know the current exile today that is coming to an end, even now, is called the Idumean exile, because that's rabbinic code language for saying the Roman exile. This is called, we live in a day and age for the last 2,000 years that's called the Roman exile. So I don't know how far you want to take that, who is the inheritor of the title of Rome, and so forth, and there's all sorts of theories about that and discussion. And is Babylon fallen? Did Babylon fall in the days of Augustine, you know, with the fall of Rome, the sack of Rome? Maybe. Is there a Babylon that's going to fall in the future? There's more than one fulfillment for biblical prophecies very often, because we see these things repeat themselves. We see patterns form in history. Empires rise and empires fall, but it's always kind of like the same characters. It's the same plot line. Things follow the same plot line. So, yeah, I do think we need to completely revise the way we've been thinking about Revelation and studying Revelation, but that doesn't mean that Revelation doesn't have pertinence for us as we come into these dangerous days of the birth pangs of Messiah. Yes?
How is the Lord's Day?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Nobody knows. The problem is this is the first reference, the first time that language is used, the Lord's Day. So the church says it's Sunday. It could be. It could be the first day. It could be that the early believers wanted to give some sort of title to the day of the resurrection, the day of the week that the Master rose on. But maybe it's an apostolic way to refer to the Shabbat. Or maybe it's Rosh Hashanah. Or maybe it's Yom Kippur. The problem is, we don't know. Now, by the time of Ignatius, which is not that much later, it's become Sunday for sure. But yeah, we don't know. Yes?
There's a passage that says, before the second advent of Christ, Elijah will come.
Yes.
Here it is.
is now when Elijah had the kingdom. So until he comes, they can't be saying, here it is. Correct?
Yes, that's correct. So a preterist position has no real answer for dealing with the two witnesses, for example. The two witnesses are in broader early Jewish messianic Jewish eschatology were understood to be, you know this, who the two witnesses are? Elijah and Enoch. Elijah and Enoch, the two who had never tasted death, come. The reason they were removed and reserved was so that they should come to herald the Messiah and the redemption, and then they taste death, fate in the fight with the Antichrist. So that was just it's an early Jewish Christian Jewish Messianic Jewish idea that the two witnesses are Elijah and Enoch. But you know, that's something that we haven't seen happen yet. Yes. No, not really. What is the 144,000, and how is that to be understood? I don't have anything of quality to say. I'd just be speculating. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Grant. Thank you so much, Beth Tikkun. It's been fun to be here with you.